This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Israeli military assassinated the spiritual leader and founder of Hamas last month, Sheikh Ahmed Yassin. He was 66. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon described him as, quote, the foremost leader of the Palestinian terrorist murderers, unquote. Now, during the Passover celebration, Israelis are bracing for a retaliatory strike. Hamas, which was founded in 1987, is known for its suicide bombings. Its military wing is very secretive. My guest, Johanna Megiri, managed to interview several of the leaders of Hamas. Megiri is the chief foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Her story, Inside Hamas, was published in last week's edition of Time. I asked Megiri to describe Sheikh Yassin's importance within Hamas.
Before Sheikh Yassin, there really was no Hamas. He had been a kind of long-time member of something called the Muslim Brotherhood, an Egyptian-based group of essentially of Islamic fundamentalists, people who believe that Islam should be the law of the land in all Muslim territory. But he was also a Palestinian, and gradually he put together both the Islamic fundamentalist notions that he had learned early on and Palestinians' aspirations for a homeland, and combined those things, if you will, into one creed that sought to put Islam at the service of regaining their lost homeland for the Palestinians.
What has the reaction been inside the territories to his assassination?
It seemed to me that of all the things the Israelis could have done that would be counterproductive, killing Yassin was one of them. He was very much revered as a spiritual leader, not as a man who sat in some little office plotting plans to kill Israelis. He was seen instead as a man of great stature, a man of great humanity, a man who represented, if you will, the Palestinians' impulses to have a homeland. And he was not seen as someone who was directly a threat to Israel, at least in the Palestinians' eyes. So killing him to them seemed, if you will, a kind of crazy act, one that was designed to inflame Palestinian anger rather than do anything to curb the violent behavior of Hamas. And I think that's pretty much been borne out to be true in the days since then.
Do you think it's safe to say that there are a lot of revenge attacks being planned now?
I'm sure that in every corner of Hamas's operations, there are people sitting around thinking about that. Exactly what they'll do, when they'll do it, is anybody's guess. Attacking Israel has been part and parcel of Hamas's entire existence since the organization was founded in 1987. But certainly the death by assassination of their spiritual leader is one that only inspires them to do worse, to do more, to do it on any occasion they can find.
The whole goal of Hamas is to push the Israelis out of territory that used to be Palestine, isn't it?
That is correct. Hamas, in essence, doesn't have a goal that's different from most Palestinians. That is, it wants to have back what it calls the territory that the Palestinians occupied before Israel ever came to be. It does carry that to extremes in the sense that its formal creed calls for throwing Israel out of all the land between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea, which would, of course, include present-day Israel. But in fact, over time, although that remains their official creed, most of Hamas's leaders have come to understand that the best they will probably obtain will be a restoration of the territories that the Palestinians occupied before the 1967 war. That is what we now call the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. And while they never officially say that that would be the end of their struggle, they do say that they would accept that kind of solution and leave it to future generations, as they put it, to decide whether to continue the struggle. That is, whether to try to displace Israel itself.
Israel has slightly changed its policy toward Hamas. What are those changes?
Well, in fact, Israel's policy towards Hamas, at least under the Sharon government, has always been a pretty simple one. Dismantle them, exterminate them, get rid of them. That has always meant that they felt perfectly free to attack anyone who was thought to be a militant, a gunman, a guy who did suicide bombings, somebody who developed explosive. But lately, they have also decided to put on their target list for what they call targeted killings. The men who are the political leaders of Hamas, these are men whose names are publicly known, who appear in public, who kind of speak for the organization. They include Yassin and also three or four other men whose names and faces are known. But they are now at the top of Israel's list for targeted assassination. And the idea seems to be to try to wipe out as many, if not all of them, as possible.
How is the seeming increase in Israel's actions against Hamas connected, if at all, to Sharon's stated intention to withdraw unilaterally from the Gaza, to pull out the Israeli settlements from the Gaza without any kind of, you know, treaty behind it?
Well, it certainly appears that there will be a step up in Israeli attempts to do what they call decapitation, to get rid of Palestinian leaders they don't like. That certainly includes the leadership of Hamas, but it also includes Yasser Arafat. And only this week, Sharon has made it quite clear that Arafat is moving towards the top of his list of targets for assassination. The Sharon government has long believed that if they could decapitate, get rid of the leaders of all of these groups that they don't like, then somehow both rebellion would end in the occupied territories and the Palestinians would be willing to accept whatever kind of deal Israel wanted to give them. As far as the Palestinians are concerned, of course, they're not very willing to do that, and they regard Sharon's targeting of leaders as very much a statement that he doesn't want to negotiate, that he wants to get rid of anybody who might be capable of negotiating with him. And that only makes them more and more unwilling to negotiate because they don't see themselves as willing to negotiate from a position of weakness.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Johanna McGeary, and she's chief foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Last week, she wrote a piece called Inside Hamas. Now, you've interviewed several people who have worked within Hamas in relatively high leadership positions. What are some of the explanations you've been given from people inside Hamas from their point of view, justifying suicide attacks and other terrorist actions?
For the Palestinians, it all seems quite logical. And I think you kind of have to live their life to understand why that's true. In the Gaza Strip in particular, people are very much locked away from the rest of the world. There is no way out of the Gaza Strip for Palestinians except through one checkpoint that is rigorously controlled by the Israelis. So you have 1.5 million Palestinians in this very small piece of territory who experience every day the effects of an occupation that gets ever more relentless and ever more difficult. There are soldiers everywhere. Houses are demolished every day. From the Palestinian point of view, the Israelis are oppressive, suppressive, violent, and have weapons that are far greater than anything the Palestinians themselves have. The Israelis have tanks. They have F-16 airplanes. They have Apache helicopter gunships. They have armor. They have all the weapons of a modern military. And all the Palestinians have are AK-47s that they smuggle in, explosives that they make themselves, and people who are willing to blow themselves up. They also believe that suicide bombing is a very potent weapon. It sends a huge message, not just to the Israelis, but to Palestinians and to everyone in the world, that they are willing to die themselves for their cause. And they see that their suicide bombing very much in that context, as opposed to the way in which the outside world sees it, which is, these horrible attacks on civilians who are innocently going about their lives in Israel. They don't deserve to die. But from the Palestinian point of view, that's what happens to Palestinians every day under the weapons and the force of the Israeli army.
listening to you talk about Hamas, and obviously as a reporter you're trying to convey their point of view, I think it would be easy for somebody to walk away and say, well, she's really sympathetic to Hamas and anti-Israel.
I'm not talking here about my personal opinions. I'm trying to convey what Hamas people said to me, how they feel. And it's important that that distinction should be made.
Let's just flip perspectives for a moment. When you're in Israel, covering Israel, how does the threat of Hamas attacks seem on Israeli land?
If you're in Israel and you're looking at Hamas, you don't see these people as resistors to an occupation. You see them essentially as terrorists, as people who are willing to walk into your country and attack you in a restaurant where you're eating lunch, on a bus when you're trying to go to work. That doesn't feel like a war. That feels like something unfair. And certainly it is true that for all that the Western world agrees with the principle that the Palestinians deserve a homeland, a nation of their own, there is no sympathy at all outside the occupied territories for the methods that Hamas uses. I mean, there is something morally repugnant to most Westerners, certainly to non-Muslims, about the use of suicide bombers. And there's also something, I think, disturbingly absolutist about the objectives that that people in Hamas particularly declare. That is, they want to wipe out Israel. I mean, that's simply considered an unacceptable outcome. And I think Hamas has both tainted the Palestinians' cause overall by its use of suicide bombings, certainly driven away a lot of political support by the way it talks. It can often sound anti-Semitic because it talks about the Zionists who've come and taken over our land. And that kind of thing is repugnant to the outside world. And I think that Hamas often makes a great mistake in terms of both its rhetoric and some of its actions because they're so blatantly counterproductive. The outside world doesn't accept this as a fair, let's say, as a fair way to fight the battle. And that has definitely hurt it, not just Hamas as an organization, but hurt the entire Palestinian cause.
My guest is Johanna Magiri, chief foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Her article Inside Hamas was published in last week's edition. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Johanna Magiri is my guest. She's chief foreign correspondent for Time magazine. Last week she wrote a long story called Inside Hamas. One of the people that you interviewed in Hamas gave you the name of Mohammed. We'll get to what his real name was in a couple of minutes. But how did you get to meet him?
Like every reporter who goes to Hamas, I work with a translator. In my case, he's a man who is a Palestinian journalist who lives in Gaza, and through him, I made the contacts in Hamas with people whom I interviewed for this story.
And how were you taken to see him?
Meeting Mohammed, who was, since he is now dead, a militant gunman for Hamas, was one of those experiences that always makes you wonder, first of all, why people are willing to talk to journalists at all when they're in such a precarious situation. But this man decided that he was willing to talk to me. And so he arranged a meeting. The first meeting I had with him took place out in the open. It was a kind of hide and play in sight thing in which he said that, since he knows my translator, that if we would be at a certain street corner during the demonstrations that Hamas always holds after Friday prayers in Gaza City, that he would come and find us and we would talk as we walked down the street, essentially amid a huge crowd of Hamas people. And in that way, he would feel protected in case the Israelis were looking for him, as he is a fugitive, or even in case it turned out that I was somebody who was not who I claimed to be.
And is that what you did?
That is exactly what we did. And we had an interview walking. I'm trying to write as we walked down the street. He then agreed to talk to me again in a somewhat more private location. It is true that already by this point, this was in the middle of last summer, Hamas activists were not supposed to ride in cars. They did not use their cell phones. They were trying to prevent themselves from being picked up by Israeli electronic surveillance. So he agreed to meet me a second time on a beach in Gaza. He liked to go swimming. It was his one kind of relief from his militant activities. And so he told me to come to the beach at a certain time, and we would meet there. And we did. He kind of emerged out of the sea and came to meet us. He had some bodyguards with him. He explained that we would get inside our car, my car, not his car, and that we should roll up the windows and turn on the air conditioning so that when we talked, the windows would become opaque and nobody could look in. And that's where we conducted our longest interview.
Do it in your car so that no one would blow the car up because they'd want to protect
exactly.
you?
Exactly. Uh-huh. He was, as it turned out, killed on the same beach about 2 months later, not very far from where I had met him, doing the same thing. He had gone for a swim, and he was back in his car, and the Israelis tracked him electronically, I think by a walkie-talkie, and sent missiles into his car and killed him.
So you don't think you inadvertently helped lead Israeli authorities to him?
I do not believe so. Certainly it was 2 months later. It's a worry that you always have when you meet people like this. I mean, you worry both ways. Are they going to be a danger to me? Am I going to be a danger to them? And in this case, I trusted both his instincts for survival and my translator's knowledge of the area to assume that I was not putting him in direct danger. But the Israelis had been tracking him for many months. He was well known to them for quite a long time.
So what are some of the most interesting things he told you about himself or Hamas?
Well, certainly one of the things that you realize about militants who work for Hamas is of course, how dedicated they are. I mean, they truly believe that what they're doing will somehow achieve their goals. I mean, to me, one of the most puzzling parts of the Hamas creed is how their militant actions are going to gain them a Palestinian state. To them, the logic seems to be self-evident. That is, if they are fighting to end the occupation, and one day they will succeed. And no matter how often you ask them if some of their actions, particularly suicide bombings, aren't in fact counterproductive, I mean, they simply deny it. They simply say, no, that's not true, and we're resisting, and this is all about resistance, and by resisting, we will one day throw off the occupation.
Did you ask him how he feels about being part of a group that is asking, that is encouraging young men and women to blow themselves up, to use themselves as human bombs?
Of course, this is one of the first questions that Westerners always ask. But for Palestinians, at least those who are Muslim, it's not puzzling at all. I mean, whether the martyrdom comes as a suicide bomber or because you've been shot by Israeli guns or you know, fought in a war, to them is all one and the same thing. Muslims are enjoined by their religion, they believe, to fight for their beliefs and to fight for their land. And if they die in that cause, however they die, whether it's by blowing themselves up or being shot by a tank, it seems like the same thing to them. And is a form of martyrdom and is one of the highest honors in Islamic theology. So they don't see it as strange at all.
Of course, this form of martyrdom, being a suicide bomber, is very controversial among Muslims. Many Muslims would not agree that form of martyrdom is encouraged in the Quran. In fact, many Muslim scholars say suicide of any sort is considered a bad thing.
I agree. I'm not an Islamic scholar, so it's not an issue about which I had strong theological debates with anybody. But to their mind, and certainly according to the preachings of the imams that Hamas people listen to, this is perfectly acceptable. So whether or not it is in Islam overall is something that they'll have to settle for themselves. But at least as far as the adherence of Hamas goes, they believe that this is sanctioned by their religion and is part and parcel of being a good Muslim.
What was he proudest of all the things he had done for Hamas?
Well, you know, it's interesting to listen to somebody take great pride in essentially being a guerrilla soldier, if you will. I mean, most of what Hamas does is classic guerrilla warfare. It's hit-and-run raids. It's going to shoot up Israeli checkpoints. It's lobbing grenades and rockets at settlements. It's doing a lot of the classic kinds of things that the guerrillas in all of these type of wars have done. But Mohammed did say that one of his proudest achievements was a raid that he had planned on an Israeli settlement inside Gaza, which had required him and his men essentially to pose as Orthodox Jews. And, of course, the irony is that Hamas men and Orthodox Jews look exactly alike. They're bearded, they're dark, they can wear somber clothes. And so it's quite easy for Hamas militants to look like a lot of the Jews who inhabit the settlements in places like Gaza. And he had planned a raid in which he did that and then killed some settlers. And he thought that it had been a good act on the part of his unit.
Johanna Magiri is Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent. Her article, Inside Hamas, was published in last week's edition. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Johanna Magiri, Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent. Her story, Inside Hamas, was published in last week's edition. She has interviewed several leaders of the group, including a leader of the military wing who used the name Mohammed when he spoke with her. Now, the person who told you his name was Mohammed was killed a couple of months after you spoke with him by the Israeli military. What are some of the things you learned about him after his death?
Well, it turned out that he was a very high-ranking member of Hamas, much more important than I had thought. His actual name was Ahmad Ishtawi, and he was a senior commander in Hamas, not only for Gaza, where he operated, but he was also a liaison to the Hamas cells in the West Bank. And only the very highest-ranking members of the Hamas militant wing know who is in more than one cell. They're a very secretive organization. They operate in little independent cells. But Ishtawi was quite an important commander. And he had formed many groups. The particular unit he had first started was a very famous one. He did a lot of organizing. He had been a student leader in a university in Gaza, and so he knew a lot of young people. He did also seem to have been responsible for bringing in weapons into Gaza, which were mostly smuggled, I think probably from Egypt, some by sea. And he collected a lot of money, distributed it to other cells so they could carry out their operations. He even, I was told, designed the Hamas logo. So he was quite a high-ranking figure and much revered in the organization. He was considered a great hero by them when he died.
And he was only 24 when he died.
He was only 24.
Were you in the Gaza after his death? Were you there to see how he was honored?
No, in fact, I was in Gaza to talk again to the top leaders of Hamas in order to, you know, to find out whether their political philosophy had changed in any way, whether before we printed this story there was any movement essentially on the political front. But that's also when I found out who Mohammed, whom I had interviewed, was. And it gave me a chance to go back and talk to his family. And that's where I learned all of these details about him, where I was shown the Hamas posters. Hamas always paints portraits of its dead militants and plasters posters of them all over as sort of acts of veneration. And so there he was. And that's how I found out a lot more about him than I had even known when I interviewed him himself. Although he was quite candid about a lot of what he did, he never indicated what his rank was or what his connections were to other people in Hamas. He always protected everyone else.
Now, you interviewed somebody named Salama Hamed. Am I saying his name correctly?
Yes, you are.
Who spent 15 years in Hamas, 12 years in Al-Qassam, and one of the things he does is make rockets, or one of the things... Yeah, I guess he's still alive, isn't he?
Yes, he is.
Now, what are some of the things he shared with you about his method of working?
Salama Hamad was considerably older than Mohammed and has been in the organization longer, but I would say he's a bit more of a foot soldier. He, like many, kind of graduated up through the ranks. You start usually doing hit-and-run raids using rifles, and then depending on your skills, you might take on different activities for Hamas. Salama Hamad is a man who specializes in making explosives, and he runs some of the little clandestine factories that make the homemade bombs and rockets that Hamas uses primarily against the settlements inside Gaza, or in the case of the West Bank, against settlers there, or against Israeli Defense Force units who are in the occupied territories.
And some of the equipment that he was working with was booby-trapped. What was the story?
When I first met Salama, I met him at the morning for another Hamas fighter who had died. One of the few places nowadays that fugitive Hamas people feel safe is inside these mourning tents when a Hamas person dies. They set up tents, and there are 3 days of mourning where friends and relatives and acquaintances and organizational cronies come to give their condolences to the family. This is a place where Hamas militants feel safe enough to come out in the open. And that is where I met Salama, who was perfectly willing to talk about himself. That is his real name. He did not feel constrained to use a pseudonym because, as he said to me, Israel already knows all about me. And they certainly seem to have, because he told me a story about how in his search for more sophisticated weapons, he bought what he thought was a kind of flying drone aircraft, a small pilotless aircraft that could fire rockets. The Hamas people have fairly primitive rockets that they make themselves, but they don't go very far. So Salama was looking for something that would be a little more long range. And when this item was delivered to him, it was delivered in two parts. And he looked at the first part and, you know, looked at the pieces, and it seemed okay. And then when he went to unwrap or deal with the second part, it blew up. It had been booby-trapped, and the entire item had been sold to him by someone who was collaborating with the Israelis. He was not killed, but he was seriously injured and lost a great deal of his hearing, so that today he wears a hearing aid. And that's what led me to ask him what had happened, because I saw this wire going into his ear, and I thought, is he wearing some kind of microphone, some kind of earpiece? But no, it was a hearing aid, which he needed after this particular incident.
Johanna McGeary is my guest. She's chief foreign correspondent for Time magazine, and her article Inside Hamas was published last week in Time. How does Hamas win the loyalty of so many Palestinians? What are some of their techniques for getting people on their side emotionally, politically, spiritually?
Hamas really exists in two parts. One part, of course, is the militant part, and it is the martyrs, those who die for the cause, who generate a certain amount of support for Palestinians, particularly in Gaza, I think even more than in the West Bank. This is something that wins a lot of sympathy, even among people who don't necessarily share the ultimate beliefs of Hamas and who wouldn't ever consider being a suicide bomber or even a gunman themselves. They do appreciate the sense that some among them are willing to do these things to make sure that the Palestinian cause is not forgotten. That's one half, I think, of how Hamas acquires the power that it has among Palestinians. The other half, which is the half I think most people outside of the occupied territories have no idea about, is that Hamas is a huge benevolent organization. It does an enormous amount of social work. It has cradle-to-the-grave programs that go from educating kindergarten kids to providing medical care to giving handouts to needy people. And it is very widespread. It is very admired for these charitable works. It is considered the only honest, non-corrupt organization among the Palestinians. And the more that Palestinians see the authority run by Yasser Arafat as corrupt, as run by cronies of Arafat, as dishonest, the more Hamas appears clean and honorable in contrast. And that has also brought them a huge following among Palestinians. Every survey that's done currently among Palestinians in Gaza and the West Bank show that a minimum of 33% of the population say that they are Hamas. And that's a huge number of people. Most of them would never pick up a gun, would never strap on an explosive belt, but they admire the organization for its charitable works, for its incorruptibility, and for its religious zeal.
You briefly spoke with the person who is the new leader of Hamas, who was the number two to the sheikh who was assassinated in March by the Israeli military. What were your impressions of him, and what is he known for within Hamas?
I actually had two interviews with Abdul Aziz Rantizi, one last summer and then one in February. He has been for quite a long time the leading political leader, if you will. Sheikh Yassin kind of stood above everyone. He was a spiritual man. He did not direct things in strictly political terms, but he kind of mediated over the entire organization. He settled disputes among leaders. He was the last word, the ultimate authority. Now that he is gone, his place is really filled by a different kind of person. Abdulaziz Rantisi is a medical doctor. He has been an open political leader of Hamas for many years. But he was one of three or four who kind of operated together, if you will, under the level of Yassin. He was, however, I think, considered to be the number two. He's a very tough man. He, I think, is quite hard-nosed about Hamas, about its creed. I would say he's probably less flexible than some others. The most flexible, I think, of the known Hamas political leaders, a man named Ismail Abu Shanab, was assassinated by the Israelis in August. So his moderating voice is gone. Rantizi himself was recovering from an Israeli assault when I met him in June. All of these men are very much in the Israelis' gun sights. So it's a little hard to know exactly how well they're going to manage under the current circumstances. But Rantizi is tough. He's strong. He officially has the kind of title of number one, but he will have to listen to a lot of other people, not just those who were with him in Gaza, but also the two leaders of Hamas who live outside of the occupied territories in Damascus. And they represent another voice, mostly from the Palestinians who are still exiled from the occupied territories. And they have a strong influence on what Hamas thinks, particularly in terms of how much territories should be returned, since most of them come from land that is now inside Israel. So I think what you're going to see is probably a toughening up of the line. It's going to be a little bit harder for Hamas to finesse its strict we must have back all of the land of ancient Palestine kind of line under these guys.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us, and I wish
you're
you
welcome.
Safe travels in your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Johanna Magiri is Time Magazine's chief foreign correspondent. Her article, Inside Hamas, was published in last week's edition.